time. Now, we all know something about what it means to climb the corporate ladder, right? When we use that phrase, we know what we mean. The person is striving hard, working hard, getting promotion after promotion after promotion, sacrificing sometimes their families so that they can reach that success, they can reach those goals of whatever it is at the top of the corporate ladder. Most people get up on the top and they say, is that all there is? You know, I've wasted my life getting here, but they are now at the top. Satan, in this sense, sought to climb the divine ladder. He wanted to get the top, but guess what? He wasn't even willing to work hard. He wasn't willing to sacrifice anything. He just wanted it handed to him. He wanted God's glory, God's power just handed to him. And as he watched over the universe, God ruling over the universe, he said to himself, you know what? I am confident I can do as good of a job as he is. Maybe even a better job. And this is the incredibly common belief of those who live under authority. And that is, by the way, all of us here. How many employees think they can do a better job than their bosses? Right? How many times have you sat there, maybe in your little cubicle, and said, man, this guy, this woman above me doesn't know nothing. I could easily outperform them. How many privates in the army secretly think they are far superior to their commanding officers? How many assistant vice presidents of these companies are convinced they are the rightful heir to the throne of that company? How many kids don't like being under the authority of their parents? Now that really starts to hit home. Now it's true that many presidents, many bosses, many people are in authority are incompetent. And oftentimes there are people that are under them who would do a much better job. That's true, we realize that. But that does not justify our rebellious attitudes. That we are just prone to hate authority. Ever since we heard the first word, no. Ever since we were babies, ever since we heard that word, we don't like it. We do not like people telling us no. We do not like telling people what we can do, what we can't do. We are inherently rebellious against all manner of authority. And this is Satan's strategy. It was to attack God's authority structure. Now think about it. He comes as a serpent. And as a serpent, where does he fall in this authority structure? The very bottom. The very bottom. But he tried to usurp that level of authority. And as Satan, did he wield any authority over that first couple? None whatsoever. So he comes in as the lowest in God's creation, as a serpent. He comes in with absolutely no authority at all. But look at the damage he does. Despite having no official authority, look at the damage that he did. Now, who was the rightful head here of the human race? Adam. Adam was obviously God, but Adam was the designated head of the human race. And who did Satan go to? Not Adam, but Eve. Do you see? He was usurping that authority structure as well. He could have went to Adam, but he chose to tempt Eve instead. And what was the main temptation? To be like God. But inherent in this temptation was for the woman to rise above the man in authority structure. Do you see that? Satan was trying to usurp God's authority on several levels. He was saying that animals are above men and women. He was saying that women should be above men, and that ultimately men and women ought to rise above God. It was an attacking of this authority structure at multiple levels. Now, Eve succumbed to this temptation, right? And who do we blame? You know, if Eve had not succumbed to that temptation, we would not be in the mess we are today. Eve was weak. Eve didn't do what she was supposed to do. All right, my question is, though, where was Adam? Where was Adam? Did you see it in the text? Did you notice it? We pass over it. Let's read verse 6 again. When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. Have you missed that before? Who was with her, and he ate it. See, as far as we can tell, Adam was standing beside his wife during that entire conversation. He never once interrupted the serpent. He never once asserted himself as head over the beast and protector of the woman. He didn't say, "Get out of here. This is my territory. This is God's realm. Be gone with you." No, instead, he just stood there. Adam was a wimp and a coward. Adam was a wimp and a coward. Now think about it this way. Husbands, you're at home, your family's at home, a stranger breaks into your house, proceeds to attempt to assault your family. Are you going to stand there and watch the whole thing play out, just stand there as a quiet bystander? Of course not. If you have even a shred of decency in you, you are going to do everything you can to protect your family. You're going to grab a baseball bat or a club or a lamp or a book or your bare hands, whatever it takes. You will sacrifice your very life if it's necessary to protect your family. But you see, when the serpent crawled into that garden, he had no authority there. He had no business there. He was an intruder, just like an intruder breaking into your house. And when the serpent started to talk with Eve, it was like an intruder beginning to assault your family. And when the serpent hooked Eve with his trap, it's like he just dispatched your family, like he just killed them all before you. So Adam stood there and watched the intruder break into his home, beat his wife to death. Adam was a wimp and a coward. There's no question about it. And before he even took a single bite of that forbidden fruit, he had lost the battle. He had lost the battle before it even began. He lost the battle when he first laid his eyes on the serpent and decided right then to do nothing. On April 9th, 1965, General Robert E. Lee walked into Appomattox, Virginia, and signed terms of surrender in the Civil War. He officially surrendered, but he had already lost the war, had he not? The war was lost before he walked into that house and signed. All he had to do was make it official. In the same way, I believe that Adam, even before he took that bite, I mean, we say, you know, that was the determining thing, wasn't it? There it is. That was the fall of man. I don't think so. I think he lost the battle before he took that bite. And that bite just made it official. That was like signing the terms of surrender. It's a done deal. It's sealed in, unfortunately, his blood and ours. And too often, this is the kind of battle that you and I have with Satan. We lose the battle before it even begins. We catch even a glimpse of the enemy, and we just lay down our arms. We just give up the fight right there. I think Adam, as you and I can benefit from James 4:7. Most of us are very familiar with this verse. Submit yourselves then to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Do you see the three parts there? See the three parts? Submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Now, too often, we go to the second part. Too often we try to resist the devil without submitting to God. And that's exactly what was happening to Adam. He couldn't possibly resist Satan's temptations because he was not submitting himself to God in any sense at that time. He was not submitting to God in reference to gender roles as his rightful head of the human race. He was not submitting to God by obeying God and his commands. He could not submit to God because he was not first resisting the devil. And again, this is our problem as well. We can refuse to submit to God in some area of our life, but we don't want the devil bothering us. Get out of here. We don't want any of his influence at all, but we can't have it both ways, can we? We can't walk in rebellion against God and still fight Satan at the same time. Now, you might be active in spiritual warfare. Some people are more gifted in that sense. You may understand the strategy of Satan better than myself, better than anyone in this room. But unless you are first submitted to God, your resistance is futile. Your resistance is futile. Now, when I say rebelling against God, now you may not be in active, full-blown rebellion against God where you go around shaking your fist at him. If that was true, you probably wouldn't even be here this morning. But the kind of rebellion that I'm talking about is areas of your life that you have knowingly not submitted to God. You know what it is. Most of us probably have one. What is that area? Something in your finances? 401k, maybe some retirements. You don't want to submit that to the Lord. Something in your family, some parenting issue, some decision, some big life thing facing you. What is that area where you ultimately know, I have put this outside of God's domain? In that sense, you are living right now in rebellion against God. And if you are not submitting that area to the Lord, you cannot resist Satan's ploys. So that's our first warning this morning. Second point, the serpent attacks God's moral standards. Now, even though this attack of Satan was cloaked in kind of fancy words, Satan's ultimate desire was to contradict God's moral standards. Reminds me of Isaiah 5:20, which reads, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." Now, as Christians, we realize there are many so-called gray areas in life, right? Some areas that people have certain convictions about that you may not share those convictions. Now, there are areas, obviously, black and white. You must not eat of this fruit from the tree that is in the middle of the garden. We have many black and white areas, but also gray areas as well. And we want to express our freedom, don't we? We have Christian liberty. We have Christian freedom, and we should want to express that freedom. But sometimes we just go too far. Sometimes we become what's known as libertines. We're just expressing our liberty at will and ultimately then are in rebellion against God in that sense. So be on guard against calling something good that is evil or calling something evil that is good. Next point. The serpent tempts with pride, power, and prestige. Probably the best known line in this passage, we've already talked about it from verse 5, "You will be like God." Now the irony here is that they were already like God, were they not? They were created what? In the image and likeness of God. They were more like God than Satan was. They were more like God than we are now, because though we have the image of God, it is a fallen image. They were already more like God than they could possibly ever be. But still, they succumbed to that temptation. And think about it. Nothing good was ever withheld from them. Nothing was ever withheld from them, especially the very presence of God himself, walking with the Lord in the garden, communing with him, that perfect, unbroken relationship. They were like God. They were with God and threw it all away to gain something they thought was going to be better. Next and final point, the serpent manipulates our emotions. This may be one of his most effective strategies. Now, Satan did not merely offer what I would call a sterile temptation with words on page. It's written down for us, isn't it? We read it, as I read this morning, one of the things that Satan says is, "Did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden?" And we see it just as words on the page, and we fail to realize the emotional struggle, the emotional battle that was taking place. It wasn't just a simple words, but there was far more happening, I believe, here. And what was going on is a manipulation of emotions, and that's where we tend to be most vulnerable, isn't it? In our emotions, whether it's pride, anger, fear. I mean, that's where we're so weak and vulnerable, in those areas. Let me throw out some different ways of offering the same temptation and see maybe if it doesn't sound like what we are tempted with sometimes. So same temptation, little different words. You deserve better than this. Wow. That's a tough one, isn't it? You deserve better than this. It goes right to the heart of what I deserve, of what is just, of all the ways people have hurt me over the years, and I don't deserve this life that I have. I deserve something better. That was the heart of what Satan was saying to them. Try this one. You should be allowed to do this. Teens, especially, right? You hear that a lot? How can your parents not let you do that? Can't believe they're so cruel. How about this one? What's wrong with it anyway? I know my wife talks about this a lot, uses it with the kids. You know, that's a common question. What's wrong with it? Do you see that's a wrong question? What's a question we should be asking? What's right with it? Not just, what's wrong with it? You're looking for little chinks in the armor, aren't you? I know there's something that I can worm my way into if I just try hard enough, if I just keep battling my parents. Eventually, I'm going to find that little chink in the armor. Boom, I'm in, baby. That's what's happening when you're asking the question, what's wrong with it? You see, it's not just the content of the question that Satan asked, but it was the tone of the question that itself can deceive and be manipulative. See, one can imagine that the serpent was very shocked at God's command. Do you think he said, did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden? Do you think it was kind of this clinical, indifferent question? No. He said, did God really say? Did he really say you can't eat from any tree? Come on, you got to be kidding me. Did God say that? You see, it's the same question, but with a very manipulative tone. You see, such questions are part exclamation, part question, part shock. You know, you've got to be kidding me. Your parents don't let you do that? I mean, I've been doing that for years, and they don't let you do that? Are you telling me? Your parents won't let you go to this movie, listen to this music, fill in the blank, whatever it is. See, such questions like that are intended to shame you. They are meant to shock you so that they move you in a different direction. You're going this direction. If they apply enough shame and pressure, that you're going to move in the direction that they want you to go. Now, see how that works. If someone just comes to you and tries to get you to violate God's standards, your standard, your conscience, you might be able to resist. If they just come to you, again, with this clinical indifference, let's go do this. You might be able to resist. But if they're applying that shame to you, that shock, that awe, then they're more likely to succeed because we're so easily manipulated at this emotional level. And again, I think this is a special warning. I think this is for all of us, but I want to talk to teens and young people now. Because for your whole life, people have been telling you, no. No, no, no. Mom, can I? No. Dad, can I? No, no, no. Your entire life. This is your domain. You can do this, and there's a whole life out here that you can't do, right? It feels like, oh my goodness, this whole universe that has been denied me, and my parents have not allowed me to go there, and I'm only here in this little box. And we have this inherent rebellion within us. And especially as you get to those teen years, that's the point where you're growing, right? You're allowed to make more decisions. Your environment is being spread a little bit more. But guess what? You want more. You're not satisfied with a little more. You want a lot more. You have this natural desire to want to rebel against your parents. And then on top of this natural inclination to rebel, you see, other people your age, what? They also have that same natural inclination to want to rebel. So what happens when you put two rebellious people together? Well, I'm not so good at math, you see, but I think you've just doubled your potential to rebel. I call this your PRQ, your potential for rebellion quotient. And when you've got two teens together, you've just doubled your PRQ. And if you've got four teens together, what have you done? You've quadrupled your PRQ. Well, if you've got eight teens, you get where I'm going with this. What happens if you have 1,000 teens together in a high school? Wow. Got like a nuclear PRQ explosion, right? I mean, just ready to go off. See, if this were not enough, it's complicated by the fact that the parents of every teen have different standards, right? I mean, we could take every parent, and if we had the list of their standards, they'd all be just a little bit different. So we have Sally over here. She's allowed to go to basically any movie she wants. And Bobby, he's allowed to listen to any music that he wants. And Jimmy or somebody else, sorry, Jimmy, I'm just throwing out names. I don't mean to pick on you. Is allowed to go wherever he wants, on his bike or his car. But the problem is that you're not allowed to do those things, but Sally and Bobby, sometimes they take great pleasure in regularly reminding you of your long list of things that you're not allowed to do, and she or he is allowed to do. I can't believe your dad won't let you go to the movie with me this week. I mean, it's only PG-13, for heaven's sakes. Bobby comes along and says, oh, dude, listen to this song I just downloaded from iTunes. You got to hear it. Oh, yeah, that's right. You're not allowed to listen to that music. I can't believe your mom won't let you wear this cute top. I mean, look at this thing I just bought. Now, you could go buy one, and we could be like twinsies, you see? We could run around, and we'd be so cute together. Bobby and Sally know where to hit you. It's at the emotional level. And all these comments are nothing more than not-so-subtle attempts to shame you into rejecting your parental authority. And for teens, your parental authority is God's authority. I don't care if you hate me after I say that. I'll say it again. For teens and young people, your parents' authority is God's authority. Teeny boppers like Sally and Bobby excel at shaming other teens into following them. They are experts at manipulating your emotions to get you to violate your conscience, to get you to violate your God. They are like skilled surgeons. They know just the right amount of pressure to apply to you, because if they apply too much pressure, you're going to run away. It's going to be too obvious. And if they don't apply enough pressure, you're not going to be convinced. But they know. They know just the right amount of pressure to apply to get you to do what they want you to do. And who are Bobby and Sally? Whose work are they doing? They are foils for Satan. They are probably believers, hopefully, but at the same time, doing the very work of Satan. So how do we fight? How do we fight against this strategy? Well, I go back to James 4. Submit to God first. Resist the devil. And we have that promise. He will flee from you. Let me contemporize this a little bit. Submit to your parents. Resist Sally. And she will flee from you. Now, I don't mean that you chase your friends away. Okay? I don't mean you just reject your friends and you go live in some isolated cave somewhere. But if you submit to God by submitting to your parents, and then in that sense you're resisting Sally or Bobby, whoever they are. Now, one of two things are likely to happen. Either Sally is not going to like you. She's just going to say, I'm tired of this. She never wants to do what I want to do, what I want to listen to, what I want to wear. Or the other thing that might happen is she grows in respect for you. And she begins to think, I wish I had that kind of courage. I wish I were not such a coward and a wimp myself. I don't know what's going to happen. But submit to God. Resist people like that, and Satan will flee from you. Everyone has the same choice before them, and that's whether you're currently still under your parents' authority or you're out on your own calling your own shots. You can either walk in the garden with your Savior or you can walk down the street with the devil. You see, the first one loves you. The second one hates you. The first one laid down his life for you. The second wants you to lay down your life for him. we must submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. I think a good reminder, a way to do that, is to share in the Lord's Supper together, as we're going to do in a moment. I don't always give warnings. I occasionally give warnings as we celebrate the Lord's Supper. I think it's appropriate this morning to remind us the warnings in 1 Corinthians 11, that we partake in a holy and reverent way, that if there is serious unresolved conflict with brothers and sisters in the body or elsewhere, that we ought not to partake. If there are areas of our life where we know we are in definite rebellion against God, we need to get that right first. And maybe you can take care of business between here and there. Maybe you just shouldn't partake at all. That's between you and the Lord. We practice at Grace Church open communion. So if you are a child of God, if you've been saved by the blood of Christ, He is your Lord and Savior, we encourage you to participate. Please go down both sides of the table, take the elements, have a seat, and we'll partake together.